we are born to be kings. We're the princes of the universe.
This is hilarious. So we'll talk about it. But the fact there are all these cut scenes, I had no idea about. This is fascinating to me. So
I have to say, I think this is one of those films where I thought that I had seen it, and it turns out that I didn't.
Yeah, same here. I think somebody showed me a portion of another Highlander that also includes this guy and Connery, but it was certainly not this one.
Oh,
that
Highlander
must have been two.
We can talk about Highlander 2 and 3.
We should.
And
we totally. We totally should never do that ever.
And 5.
There's 5.
There's 5. I thought there were 3. The reason we're doing this is on some incomparable taping. Highlander came up and someone mentioned there were 5, and I only knew of 3, and I've only seen 2 because the number. And they're like, "Oh no, they get even worse." Like, what? How can it be worse than 2 or 3?
How can anything be okay? How can a movie like this? I guess we're into it already. How can a movie like this get made in the first place, and then more of them be made? Like, I don't understand how somebody put this movie out and then went, "Sure, that was awesome. Let's do some more of that."
Well, it tanked is the funny part. Like, so I have a. Are we into it? We're going right.
This
is
sure.
It. All right. Well, so I have fond memories of this movie because I saw it in after high school. These people I used to hang out with, a bunch of buddies from high school, when we were all off in college, we'd come back for the summer, and I think I would just get baked and watch this over and over again. So it's kind of, you know, in patterns in my brain. But I watched it again. I'm like, all right, it's really cheesy, but I kind of like it. It's so ridiculous. It doesn't make sense in parts, but it's so good natured about what it does. It's supposed to say Zardoz.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All I know is this, excluding the ads on Hulu, this is the longest 2-hour movie I think I've ever seen. It felt like it was about 6.5 hours long.
Oh, man. It does. Well, the version they have out is, I think, the extended, it's like the director's cut. Or it's
good.
Because I didn't remember being that long either. I think the cut I saw was at least 15, I forget what they said. I was looking this up, either 8 or 15 minutes shorter. So there was a U.S. cut and a European cut, and the European cut was adapted into a director's cut, I think, as well. So, the guy behind this was like a rock video, director, and I think this is one of the first feature films he made. And it was, I remember after it came out, people said such stinko things about it, and then I watched it a few years after on video, because it was a sleeper film. It was like, oh yeah, it's a cult movie, and it did terribly at the box office, but then it's just had a life. It's immortal. It just goes on and on.
How apropos. I think that I mostly just think about the main theme by Queen and the television show, which also featured the main theme by Queen in the opening credits. So
yeah.
It's one of those things where I don't know that the film really happened across my radar very often. I don't think I'd ever seen when I was sitting there watching it. And it's meandering, so it's you have to pay attention, or else you'll forget why they're doing any of the things that they're doing. And just cutting back and forth between different vignettes of his life.
I'd forgotten how choppy it was because you kind of remember the plot. You're like, oh yeah, he's in New York and there's some flashbacks, but ultimately falls in love and he has this fight. And then it's like, oh no, this is like several different movies. For a while, it's like a police procedural.
Then
it forgets. I have this theory about this movie is they filmed it sequentially and they ran out of money as they went along, which I know is not how films are made, but it feels like that. Oh, I also found out, in researching this, I did research for this. I hope you know that Sean Connery only had 7 days to shoot.
Oh my God.
I know. And it explains so much the weird takes they used, the body doubles, the voiceover at the beginning is him. It was recorded like his villa in Spain. A sound guy flew out there to record it in an echoey room. Like all of these weird little details. He's like, I got other places to be. Let's knock this one out.
Yeah, supposedly it was, according to Wikipedia anyway, because I had never learned this factoid either, but it was the Spanish villa he was staying in with the bathroom of that. With his Spanish with his coach who was teaching him his Spanish accent that he used in the film. And I read that and I was just like, what Spanish accent?
Spanish accent. Oh my gosh.
Can we, I mean, So we should back up, man.
But I'm sorry, I jumped in here.
Oh yeah, well, I mean, we jumped all of the jumping ins. We should probably introduce you at some point.
I talked over all the waffle talk. I know this is a show about waffles. Waffles and croissants. And, yeah.
Do you have thoughts and or opinions on waffles?
Well, yeah, you know, I used to like waffles. I got braces. I got the tops. I'm getting the bottom soon at the grand old age of 47. So I don't have to get a tooth removed at some point. And so I'm like, I can't chew as much as I used to. I've been changing my diet up and around. So waffles are not so good. So I'm cutting to small pieces. Also, I may have I don't know if I have a gluten intolerance, but I find if I avoid things with gluten, so gluten-free waffles, those are not so bad. I'm in Seattle. You can get all kinds of cool things that don't have gluten in them.
Oh, you're winning all kinds of points with Joe and his not actual waffles.
Yeah, the Nature's Way gluten-free waffles, I'm telling you.
Oh, okay.
Those are quite nice for frozen waffle things.
I'm more of a pancake man.
See, are you still allowed to consume the pancakes with the apparatus?
Yeah, those are easier to cut up. But I have a list on the fridge of things I'm not supposed to eat because they will tear the metal parts out that cost so much to put in.
An important fact. Yes. Of life. So other than breakfast stuff. And what you can and cannot eat right now. What would people maybe know you for, Glenn?
possibly for glenning. It's a kind of thing that I didn't invent, but it's used, applied to me. Glenn and glenning are things that were invented for me, which I appreciate my friends having done so. Are they friends? I'm not sure. But they invented them. I'm a technology journalist. I like to write about space and cryptography and do a lot of writing about the Mac. And I have, you may not realize this, you know, I was trained as a typesetter. You probably don't know that. And like that. So yeah, so I have a background in graphic design. I've always had an abiding interest in aesthetic presentations of things, but I have no expertise in film at all, which is why I'm glad to be on this show, since you two do and I don't. So I can say stupid things out of my field, and you will say, nah, well, I don't know. Okay.
We have expertise in gigantic air quotes, so you're just as qualified as we are.
Excellent.
And we say stupid things, even though we should probably know better. So it's fine.
I actually thought of this movie for you guys after listening to the show for a while because it's full of wacky effects. There's so many different kinds of things, and so some of them are so ridiculous, and some I think stand the test of time. It's like, oh, okay, that's right. And others look totally, I mean, the exploding mannequin head at the end, I hope you caught that, so we'll talk about that.
It's one of those things where there's no consistency at all in any of the effects that they have, so every time somebody dies, it's like some new thing was drawn with the optical printer. It's amazing.
Oh my god! That's why my theory they ran out of money because they do all these incredible openings and like transitions, and then they just sort of stop those entirely. And some are completely random. That exploding effect of like the shattering glass.
Oh, you mean at the end there?
No, we may have not all seen the same version. No, that's interesting.
No, there's a transition in one of the flashbacks where all of a sudden window. It like breaks into shards and flies at camera.
Was that in your version, Dan?
Which flashback was that?
It's when he meets Rachel with the Nazis.
I may have blacked out for a moment of that. But
it may have blinked.
It may not be. See, I started watching the Hulu one. I got 10 minutes in because that's free, and it said, your movie will resume after 170 seconds of commercials. And I said, screw that, I'm out of here. And I paid $3 on Vudu to watch it because Vudu gives you 48 hours if you rent. So I went to Vudu and, I think the Vudu version is the European cut. You may have actually seen the U.S. cut.
I may have. I was looking around for another version while I was watching this because there are, I think, like 13 ad breaks, and each one of them shows 14 four ads. It's just, oh my goodness, it was incredibly slow. But I did like the Nazi flashback just because, like, oh look, which era are we in now? He's randomly strolling through some ruins, and oh, there's a man in a very pristine outfit, German outfit, shooting him in the back. That's very nice. Thank you for that.
It's good. Yeah,
it clarifies very quickly where we are.
Yes, it's a flagship thing. I don't know how you want to approach this. I think it's a giant wonder. So Joe and I have had words about Zardoz. All right. It's a terrible film, but I think it's a good terrible film. I think, Joe, I think you think it's irredeemably bad.
We
told me not to even waste my time with it is basically his description of it.
I can see that. Having seen it, I'm glad I saw it just because of the spectacle of craziness that it is.
I have to say, as far as wacky Sean Connery movies go, this is pretty mild because mostly he's not in it very much.
But the outfit is superb.
Yeah. Yes, yes, his peacock outfit. It's
amazing.
It covers
a little better than the Zardoz outfit, though.
Yeah. Oh, he does get to ride a horse, though. So it's always nice for him. Roles where he can ride horses. But Glenn, I wanted to ask you about why another Sean Connery movie did you want to talk to?
This film is, I think, I don't know if it's, gosh, would you say this is more expertly made or less expertly made than Zardoz? Neither really expertly made. Well, Zardoz is sort of expertly, I don't know. They're very similar films in certain ways. Like there's actually sort of elements of, fantasy and strangeness in both. And it's because I love this film so much and because of the visual effects. And I thought it would be fun to talk about from that standpoint because they were trying to pull together something compelling. And the Sean Connery is just a bonus. But it's also the fact that there are so many terrible sequels to it. I think that is actually something that that appeals, that they made a weird film that tanked at the box office and made four sequels somehow.
Baffling.
Yeah. I think this is probably more interesting than Zardoz for many people because it has a little bit of that pop rock music video thing to it, how it's made, in that it kind of looks like, I don't know, that Bonnie Tyler music video or any of that stuff.
You're talking about the hair?
Yeah, well, I meant
so
just like...
so 1986.
Yeah, everything in this is very 1986. And especially like, you know, you get the cues from Queen every now and then, Freddie Mercury just belting out something. Like the New York, New York is always a nice treat. But that makes this, I think, more... palatable than perhaps Zardoz is because
there's a plot. Yeah. I mean, there's a plot. Like yes. Early on, you're like, oh, they're going to cut off heads. And then you learn, okay, there's only going to be one at the end. There can be only one. You're like, okay, well, there's a direction we're heading, not into some giant mirror maze.
Although they wait till literally the last moment to explain what we're heading forward for. It's like the prize, quote unquote. So are we to assume that this whole time they had no idea what the prize was until they acquired it?
How did they even know there was a prize? Because there's no instruction manual for being an immortal.
Yeah, well,
Sean Connery knows all this stuff, but why? Why does Connery know it?
It's never explained. Like, he just shows up and he knows it. And maybe he met with other immortals. And, you know, there's this whole, it's tradition thing to never fight in a sacred holy place. And that's another thing. It's just like, so they just decided on this stuff and then they just like pass it around like person to person to the people they don't kill.
Well, and who becomes an immortal? I mean, this is, you know, some universes. Okay, so I like some universes in which they don't explain things. So the fact is random people, apparently not too many of them, are born. They're born and they're immortals for whatever reason. And they're often, you know, we see with Connor, I don't know if we want to go through the film chronologically, if that makes sense. But you know, we know that immortals are born. They're not like some extra, you know, some kind of weird thing that demons or whatever, maybe they are. I don't even know. We don't know. But they wind up in normal life, and then some number of them are left, and then they're fighting to the death, and they go back, you know, some thousands of years at least, based on Connery's tale. But they don't actually give us more explanation. They kind of do some hand wavium, as Eric Ensign might say, and then they move on. And I think that's actually good that they don't try to explain too much. When you try to explain what magic is, it just comes off sounding boring. But this is sort of slightly irritating because they give you just enough. It's like he has a lot of information for someone who should have no information.
Yeah, especially with the central premise that they must kill each other. So then it's just like, well, then how do they pass this information on if they mostly just kill each other every time they meet each other? Except that there does appear to be some immortals who are friends with other immortals, even though they know eventually at some point they're all going to kill each other. So I don't know how that works out. If it's just like some reality TV show where you make alliances and then like at the end you have to start breaking your alliances once your team has won. I don't know.
That's it.
Big Immortal Brother.
Yeah.
That was really weird, the whole, like, that sort of, like, teacher-student relationship that they had, but then, you know, the whole time he said, I'm like, one of these days, we're all gonna fight, and then whoever's left is gonna get the prize. It's like, why are you gonna train him to be super good at fighting if you have to fight him later?
Well, it seemed like they missed something, which is if they'd actually included an explanation, like Sean Connery says it at one point, Juan Sanchez Villar Lobos Ramirez, of course, he says, you know, the Kurgan's so evil, you know, we need to make sure somebody good wins, basically. And he doesn't say it as crisply, but it's clear that there's, like, you know, sort of chaotic, you know, good and chaotic evil, and maybe sort of pure good and pure evil. And we don't know about the other immortals except, you know, he meets Fazil and he kills him we don't know anything about him. So anyway, there could be a bunch of really evil guys and the Kurgan's the most evil of them all. There could be a bunch of good guys. So it's sort of a battle between good and evil, but it's an individual thing. So they're like, all right, if I teach enough guys who actually seem good to be good fighters, then we're improving the odds that that I'll die, but we're improving the odds that the world won't be run by the Kurgan at some point and mankind will be, you know, set into an eternal, terrible darkness.
Mm. So we're supposed to make that leap there at the end that the prize, this spoiler alert, jumping ahead slightly, this, for lack of a better term, telepathy thing he's got going on, if in the hands of the Kurgan, would be used for some form of manipulation or domination. So we got to make sure it doesn't fall into his hands. We got to make sure it falls into the hands of a good guy, maybe one who's slightly cross-eyed and has a deadpan face.
That's, I think you've cracked the code. I think that's what they're trying to say. But they didn't set it up, and it was set up so thinly. I just saw that, like, I know everything. I see everything. It's just perfect. The accents in this movie are pretty wonderful, too. Oh, I know something else. I have, like, another general note about the film. As I was watching, I'm, like, looking up everybody in this movie because there's some really great faces and actors. And I realized this is a film in which you have, okay, so you've got Christophe Lambert, Roxanne Hart, who's done plenty of stuff since, Clancy Brown, we see everywhere. He's sort of, like, A-minus list. Like, I don't think he's ever had a lead role in a film like this again. I don't know. Nothing.
He goes all in this movie, so I got to give Clancy Brown props for this one.
Yeah, this is an amazing role. Apparently, the crew was scared of him because he's a pretty gentle guy, from what I've read. And like, he just, you know, and so you got Sean Connery, and then everybody else are like really great B actors. Like, I'm not sure, B list actors are people who are like working character actors, not even B list. They're like people who, when you look at their credits, there have been in 150 things as like second person in crowd, like police officer. with no line. These are working stiffs and they give great performances. All those cops are fantastic. Like, they have this great, you're like we walked into some other TV show going on here, and these cops all have this whole thing going on, and Brenda's got this whole life there, and they just put their work in. I was like, this is great. I wanted to call out Alan North, who plays the lieutenant. Do you know how many police roles he played?
I have no idea, but he seems familiar to me, but not in a way that I could identify him.
Police Squad.
Oh.
He was work with Leslie Nielsen in Police Squad, playing a lieutenant or a captain in that show. And that's what he's classically known for. But he's a guy, he just seems like a cop. And so he played, if you look at his credits, he was in a million things. And this is just like one of 50 appearances. I mean, he's in 58 films. And if you scroll through him, it's like officer, policer, you know, judge, whatever, but mostly cops from his first appearance.
He's like
appearance.
That one famous Chicago cop guy who was in The Fugitive in like 8 other movies. He just plays like angry Chicago cop guy.
It's great. But it's just, I don't know, it's just kind of wonderful. I went through and looked up a bunch of people. The guy who plays Amon Fasil, Peter Diamond, I thought he was the guy from, not The Executioner, what was that TV series that was about, like, revenge? I can't remember the actor's name. But it turns out he was, he's in a million things also. He was the stunt coordinator, and they actually wound up casting him in it, and he does those amazing backflips. That's apparently him.
What?
You mean the guy who does the backflips just to get him to fall into his car there? Or in the
Why the hell is he doing the backflips? I don't know.
He's fighting with a little flair.
The fight choreography of that whole first scene made no sense to me at all.
Okay. No, it's totally ridiculous.
We should probably just talk about the opening to the film because it was a little jarring.
You mean the WWE wrestling match?
Yeah. We start with the echoey narration from Sean Connery as he reads the card, and then we go to the wrestling match, And there is apparently an actual wrestling team. I'm not sure.
I think they were actual wrestlers. I think they recruited them.
Yeah, but with the Confederate flag cape thing threw me for a loop. That was not expected. And then they had the big aerial shot of the arena. And then they go up on him, and there's all these flashes going off, and then they have the really intense light focused right on his eyes.
That was awesome.
He's
having like a PTSD flashback with that guy's just like close up of the guy's mouth shouting in the side of his face, like, kill him! It's like, oh no, this reminds me of that one time I was fighting thousands of years ago.
I told you, I did my research on this. That overhead shot was using the guy who invented the Steadicam, was it Skycam, I think it's called? That was one of the first uses of an overhead wire camera remote shot.
Yeah, you can tell they were very proud of it because it was a very long shot.
It was amazing,
very shaky.
Though.
It was sped up at points, and they just refused to cut away from this incredibly shaky shot. But when you look around, you're like, wow, how did they actually do this? You don't really see crane rigging or anything because there's nowhere to put any of that stuff. But it was nicely done for the time.
Yeah, that I remember watching this. You know, I think I first saw it probably 87 or something, and I remember thinking, God, I've never seen that. And I mean, I wasn't a film buff even. I was like, that's something new. I've never seen an establishing shot like that didn't look super fake.
Well, I mean, it drew attention to itself for yes. the camera moving, but yeah, I get what you mean.
We spent money on this.
And then, you know, he immediately leaves that, and he goes down to the parking garage, and there is the confrontation with Facile, and we don't really know what's happening, why this is happening in terms of exposition or anything. But it starts to unfold into this thing where people are running back and forth and doing flips, and things are exploding, and there's sparks everywhere, and there's swords clattering against each other, and then there's more flipping and more running, and then they're cutting across the line of action, so you lose place of who's standing where. But there's that whole thing's kind of a mess. I don't agree with how that was shot and cut. And then they
throw you into it, right? Yeah. It's all of a sudden, it's like, but I mean, although I have to say it was jarring, right? If you knew nothing about the film, and you're like, okay, I don't know what's going on here. It's like suddenly they both have swords and they're fighting with swords in, you know, what's supposed to be, I don't know, Madison Square Garden's garage or something.
No, but they pull their swords out of their jackets like Nicholson and Batman, where it's just this absurdly long thing that just was like in their jacket, presumably like going down their pant leg or something.
Magic pockets, maybe.
Sure. You know, it's just it's a flexible sword. It bends when you sit down to watch your WWF fighting.
Well, Connor's was like the short sword, the little katana thing that he had.
Yeah,
and then Facile had that longer, more ornate one.
Yeah, with the crazy handle.
Yeah, so that one was a little that would have been difficult to hide on your walk into the thing. But I guess that's why those trench coats come in handy. May I take your coat? No.
I'm going to hang on to it.
Foreshadow a future scene.
They're magic swords in more than one ways, in particular because when they touch things, things explode and sparks shoot out of them.
Oh my God, the amount of, I'd forgotten the sheer quantity. Like, I remember in the garage, I'm like, oh yeah, there's a thing. And then the body, you know, he cuts the head off and the electricity comes out and the corpse rises. And then there's like the scene, I forgot. Gotten the sheer amount of like explosions and just they keep cutting back in water, and then the best part is the hubcap rolling across, like the ultimate cliche. Whenever a car is involved in being blown up, the hubcap has to roll across the screen.
It's a modern tumbleweed.
Well, exactly. What I liked about that is that when he first kills him and the energy escapes in like that like serpentine little path that it goes on, it knocks the hubcap off of one of the cars.
Oh yeah. Like,
and so that's actually the hubcap that rolls back into frame after everything's done. So it's not great, but I got a chuckle out of it. But I don't know if that was supposed to be funny. I'm gonna guess not. And you know, he hides the sword and then spends like, I don't know, 5 minutes getting out of there. Because the police are there really fast. A lot of police are there really fast. And they're very anxious to shoot him in the head.
That seemed totally realistic to me.
Yeah. Well,
except the part where he actually like resists arrest and like hits the cop, and then they don't immediately shoot him.
Oh yeah, that was amazing. Yeah.
Well, what was really weird about that?
Don't move a muscle, Nish.
Don't even think about it. No, it. But they, when they get him back to the station,
he's calling him pal. That's how you can tell he's a cop from New York. Don't even try anything, pal.
Pal.
Yeah. When they get him back to the police station and they go through the whole thing, and of course they have the let's just say people who are probably arrested for doing things like calling in the background to be released, like they normally do in these sorts of scenarios. Then they settle into the interrogation room, and there's the oddly confrontational, I don't know anything, you don't know anything, whatever, okay, homophobic thing. And then fight, and then it's like, well, you don't have anything on me, so I'm just going to go now. And it's like, you can't go, we're not done here. It's like, you better not. And then it's just like, okay, I'm going to go. And it's just like, well, you got him on like 5 counts of assaulting a cop. Like, he can stay. Like, I don't understand this whole thing. It's so strange.
It's good, though. I just like this. I just like the, I don't know, Christoph Lambert, he apparently, his agent lied and said he spoke English, which he did not when this film was made. Perhaps it shows.
Oh God, he did.
I did not know that. Bad ADR in this movie. Just all of the bad ADR from the '80s is in this movie.
The lips moving and the
Oh God, like I listened to this with my nice headphones on because I watched it on my laptop with the Hulu, and the bar scene in particular when he's tracking down Brenda. Right? That scene. Absolutely none of that audio was recorded in that place, and it's so bad. Like they sound like they're 2 inches away from each other, and he's on the other side of the bar, speaking very softly, and it's so odd.
I just love. I mean, just forget his Scottish thing. It's just that. It's that. I'll tell you my theory. Theory is that.
Did they have him do the ADR in this, or did they have somebody else's voice?
It's him. They apparently, when he arrived, they took him off for like 6 weeks and locked him up somewhere to do intensive language immersion.
They couldn't just hire a different guy at that point?
I don't think they had the money. I think they thought, well, was Christoph Lambert in 1985? Wasn't he a get or not? I'm trying to think.
He was not. I mean, he was Metro? He had been Luc Besson's... Subway the year before this.
Oh, so wonderful. Now that's a good film.
So he got an award for that. Right. But that doesn't mean that he was technically, I wouldn't say he's a get.
Oh, he was Tarzan the year before that in the Greystoke movie, but I don't think he had that many lines, right? Mm-hmm. That was the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Have you guys seen Subway? I have not seen Subway for years. My memory of it was very fine, but maybe I'm misremembering that.
I haven't seen Subway. No.
Go see Diva. Diva's a great film. Okay. Similar era.
My only memory of him is from Mortal Kombat.
Yeah, when he's Raiden. That's primarily what I know him for.
I keep looking at him like, man, where do I know this face from? Oh, I had a lot of gray, stringy hair and a hat, and he's totally Raiden.
Yeah.
Was this the peak of his career? I mean that in the nicest way, but I'm like... As you look through the credits, I mean, because he's sort of known, like he's sort of that kind of person, like, oh, Christoph Lambert, we know Christopher Lambert, we know who he is. But I'm looking at the rest of his credits and wondering, was he ever in a big film after that?
Well, if we were to take just IMDb's known for, where they list the top 4 things they've been in, Mortal Kombat is ranked above this, but Highlander is second.
Okay. Okay. Well, I think it's the thing of that time. It's like, because I'm, you know, I came of age in the mid-80s, to me, Christoph Lambert is like, oh yeah, he's one of those movie stars, and he really isn't a movie star.
No.
You know what he is to me? Is he is a step in the evolutionary chain, one back from Thomas Chain. So he was the sort of hunched monkey on the chart, and then Thomas Chain was the upright version. And other than that, I got nothing.
That's funny.
He kind of has a Viggo the Carpathian look thing going on too.
It's just his scowling demeanor and like almost never closed lips.
Oh, he has the best dying face in that flashback when he gets first stabbed. They just like made him pale and just said, like, you know, just stare at the ceiling and like slightly open your mouth.
It's so weird. Just the faces he makes. This is really a movie about his faces.
It's true.
There are so many extreme close-ups on his eyes, and it's just kind of funny. Because he'll often not even say anything in response to other characters. He'll just like give a look, and it's just like, well, it's not really even like it's kind of a funny look. Like I don't find it threatening in any particular way.
He's got a good serious look, but like, you know, there's literally no expression in his forehead, so it's just like. It's he may as well be wearing a mask of his face.
Mm.
The we missed there's a great shot that we missed, which is the one through the is it through a fish tank when it goes to Scotland and it like comes up through the water or something and
yeah.
And then somebody, it's really nice for that priest to, or monk to announce the year. It's awesome because then we, even though I'm not sure they'd be using the Julian calendar at that point. I'm not quite sure.
No.
Or
later on when Sean Connery is talking about years in terms of BC and stuff like that. You know, it's not really a movie for historians, I don't think.
No. My favorite part is where when they first go back prior to the battle that reveals them to be immortal is they just spend the whole time, like 90% of the dialogue is them shouting their last name. Like that's all they're doing.
Yeah.
I appreciate that there was genuine filth and squalor, though, that they didn't try to prettify the village, that it's like the scene in Monty Python and the Holy Grail, right? It's like, how do you know he's a king? It's like, he's not covered with shit. It's like, yeah. Everybody is just completely filthy and wretched and sort of toothless, and you can smell it through the screen, practically. So, they went for verisimilitude. I appreciate that.
Mm. Yeah.
It, like when he dunks his head in the barrel to sort of wash off when he's playing around with Heather?
Yeah, exactly.
Let me clean up. Let me just dunk my head in this barrel that the horse was probably drinking out of.
Ugh. Yeah. Well, this is Bonnie Heather that he has to impress. Man, I don't know. I think the Scottish scenes are probably like the weirdest for me because they're so jarring whenever we go from the current police drama back to Scotland, as happens for several minute-long stretches, and then also it's kind of undermined by the fact that everyone else has a Scottish accent except for him, and then when Sean Connery shows up and he has a Scottish accent, but he's supposed to be a Spaniard, but he's supposed to be Egyptian. He's not even playing Scottish in Scotland, talking to a Frenchman playing a Scottish person. So it's very strange. It's distracting from whatever it is they're saying. especially since the dialogue leaves a lot to be desired when they're talking about how talking about haggis, of course, because you have to, and then you know talking about swimming and swearing and you know. All that stuff, and then we get the exposition dump, and then you're gonna run like the stag, and it's weird.
Those are very strange. They didn't have very much time. They didn't get those films done. Connery's like, look, I gotta go to Spain. Someone's waiting for me there. So backing up. So Brenda, I actually want to say this is a forward looking film because 1986, and she's an expert. She's not talked down to. Some of the cops give her a hard time, and she's just like, screw you. I mean, and like the smile on her face when they, you know, come on to her, whatever. It's sort of hilarious, like very desultory, whatever. But she, you know, she's a published author. It's like it does not try to demean her professional ability. She is an expert and somehow has a magnificent apartment in New York City and also has this open-ended job in an enormous lab. It's very her life is very rich without Connor McLeod in it.
Yeah,
she's a smart lady. She pulled the old "Whoops, I forgot my purse" on the police lieutenant's desk, and I'm just gonna sneak in there and look through his files real quick.
It drove me crazy. It's an office full of other people. All the other people are there, and she opens it and, like they're not. They just walked out of an office full of people. All right.
He's like, yeah, I'll meet you in the car or whatever he says. I'll see you outside or something. It's like, well, she's gonna take five steps back. You can just stand right where you're standing, and she'll be right there.
Exactly.
I mean, I like her, and I like that they made her into a, you know, a smart, intelligent person, and that she uses her wits at several points to figure out certain things, especially with the birth certificate and researching that. So she, as well as her strange side hobby of sword collecting / research, is convenient to say the least. But I mean, what are the odds of a forensic expert in New York with a palatial apartment and a passion for old-fashioned sword making? What a great fit for him. But
she kind of had her own film too. There was one maddening thing about this film. One maddening thing,
just one,
which was is they tell us everything up front. They kind of give us all the exposition. So we're not even to the end of the exposition. We haven't met the Kurgan yet, right? But we're, but they sort of tell us everything in the first, whatever that is, 20 something minutes. We know what the film is about. Several people in the movie, I mean, Brenda primarily, are trying to figure out what is going on. And there's no point to her figuring out because we know.
Yeah.
She's not a proxy for the audience because we know. We're like, Brenda, we know you don't have to do this now.
Yeah. That's also very strange, too, when you take into account the police aspect of this film. Because they serve as part of the exposition at the beginning. Well, part of the engine for the exposition unfolding at the beginning. Not necessarily. They don't impart any information themselves. But then they have a few points in the middle where there's some scenes with them, but they don't do anything. And then they're completely out of the third act altogether.
I guess you're right. But it's the, is it they're going to the third act? There's that one bit with the nerdy computer guy that when we get there, I want to talk about that. Because that was amazing. I'd forgotten how amazing that was. But that's the only thing. Like, she goes in the office and the guy does computer analysis. But that's the only, then you're done with police.
Oh, well, no, but I meant with Alan North and the other guy.
Oh, yeah, those guys, right, all the people, yeah. Right, those guys are gone for some reason. They're...
Yeah, by the third act, there's nothing to tie that back together. Like, the whole investigation of people being beheaded, the whole thing about it being in the news, none of that's revisited, no closure for them. And there isn't even a scene of them, like, coming across the Kurgan's dead body and being like, oh, well... That's one less we got to worry about now. Anybody seen this guy holding up, you know, model headshot of Christophe Lambert? But like which I don't know if you noticed, but when he has that photo that he hands to the guy in the hospital after Castigan's killed,
yeah,
and it's just like, this is just his headshot. Like, did you guys not like just take a? Like a police shot?
I wasn't paying attention. That's great.
It's definitely not a police shot. Oh, well, maybe God, they had great, really great lighting for the police department back then and didn't that's draw great. Lines for the height or anything behind them when they were booking people. But it's kind of weird that they just kind of drop out completely. Like, I think that's the last scene
them
at the hot dog stand.
And then that's it. Which that was a weird scene too.
Yeah, that was a very strange scene.
and then they're out. Although the other guy, the bald cop, winds up outside Brenda's apartment, but then we don't see him anymore. There's no interaction. He's just out there like staking him out or something.
Yeah, and Connor mentions the lieutenant to her when he's having his little hissy fit about he brought over the brandy and why is she not. You know, why is she with the police department? Why did she lie to him and all this other stuff? And it's like, well, let's cool it with the allegations of lying, Connor, Mr. Nash, shall I say? But that is the end of it. Like you're saying, with her and with them, that's another thing where they just kind of have these parts that could tell you things in the story that just kind of don't end up serving that purpose through the duration or serve it long after that purpose has been fulfilled by another piece of exposition. So it's weird. It's a weird choice. And I can't even tell if it's because of the way they cut it or if that was originally the way it was in the screenplay. I would have to do some heavy research and I don't have it in me.
The director, I think, some of this is, I think they lacked coverage for some stuff, to be quite honest. I think they didn't shoot enough. The basis of the way the film is, like, there are some takes and you're like, really? That's the one you picked. So you did not have a better one. So I don't know. And then the Sean Connery, like, not having it for very long and some of this, the access they had, they did some stuff like they apparently disassembled and moved a shrine to Queen Elizabeth that wasn't supposed to be touched and then reassembled it after they were done and crap like that. Some of them there. Mm. Interesting things. All right, wait, so the current, we have to return to the past.
Yeah. The fight with Kurgan and why won't anybody fight me? This is so weird. I'm not going to fight anyone. I'll just stand here and talk about how weird it is nobody's fighting me.
And all that the
and
lightning.
Stand there and shout his last name a couple times too.
Yeah.
I like that skull outfit. It's pretty fancy. He's got like skull breastplates and like a skull on either shoulder and like a skull on his head. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, where did he get the saber-toothed tiger that he made that out of? Because it was an awfully big head.
From the depths of time he came. From the depths of time he came?
Yeah.
He's been hanging on to that for a long time. He's just waiting for the right occasion to put on his old-fashioned saber-toothed tiger skull.
Yeah. Well, it was a collector's item back then.
They were antique dealers even back then.
Oh, my God. That's where I got the idea.
Yeah. Well... it's probably the whole genesis of the whole antique business is really just the immortals keeping old stuff around until it comes back into style. So
we call them hoarders today, but they were called immortals then.
Yeah. Well, Connor keeps a sizable collection of little mementos from his life.
I'm picturing him like an RV driving around or something, like some kind of moving van. Like, all right, time for me to give up this identity. I'll just load all this stuff up in 18th century France and take it with me somehow.
Yeah,
to a new village.
Loaded into my weird octagonal room that I keep.
That's awesome. With the couch, that beautiful round couch.
That'd be a good place to hang out and have a drink or two, you know, just chilling there.
I just love it's one of those shots where, again, the camera draws attention to itself as it slowly comes down.
Yes.
And it's just like, you guys are, there are several of these shots in the film where it's just like, you guys are really proud of how you set this up. And then there's other things where
a round room. Of course, we've got a 360 degree spin as she just walks around looking at stuff and ends up right back where she was.
Yeah. Like, but then there's all the other stuff where they take like zero care at where the camera is placed or what's happening. And it's just like, you guys, you can't just do like one thing and then like put all the effort into it. Like, please make it more consistent throughout
again,
the film.
That bar setup, it's one camera angle where you can see like everyone who needs to be in the scene, where it's like looking past her and then he's in the background and the bartender can walk. And both. It's like, you couldn't get maybe like two angles and like a close up or something. No, just the one shot, and then we'll just like punch in on it or something with a longer lens. Sure.
This gets me again. The round couch scene, his private lair scene. It gets me again because if this film had been done differently, we wouldn't know that he was immortal when he does the reveal. It is not interesting to us when he kills himself.
No, it's not even like it was like a letter opener. Did he really like kill himself? I think that's a little extreme. And obviously her surprise at it, I think, should be more like, non-existent, since she has discovered that apparently it's been the same handwriting all of this time. And he just, you know.
Can we discuss her quote-unquote surprise after she stabs him? So she stabs him. She like screams a little bit. She has some tears in her eyes. Then they make out for a bit, and then they go have sex.
Oh, but
wait, let's come. I gotta come back to this because I want to talk about the sex.
All right, then.
Oh man, yes, poor guy. Yeah. You poor guys.
You want to hold off on it a little
bit? I want to come back. Let's
add some suspense to it.
We'll circle back to the circle.
I want to circle back because there are things to say. There's a body double issue. The reason I bring that up, and we'll talk about that, is the body double issue. There are a lot. Now, I'm used to seeing the movies. I know body doubles are used for all kinds of stuff, especially when you're doing stunts and whatever. There are so many body doubles in this film. There are so many times when it is obviously not the person, and I can't figure out why. Like with Sean Connery, he just wasn't available. So there's scenes in which they use a body double because he was gone. But those are times when it's clear, like Christophe Lambert should be there because it's a scene. You've seen him in that scene before, that setting. He's in Scotland or wherever. So the actor should have been available, but they use a body double. So anyway, it's just sort of amusing. A lot of the shots, they just kind of, I guess, felt that was a better use of people.
I'm not entirely sure I noticed. Perhaps just speaks more to a lack of scrutiny on my part.
Well, having seen it 100 times, I may.
Why would you do that to yourself?
It was the pot. I'm just going to tell you.
I was going to say, do you really have an affinity for this film, or is it just one of those things that's personal to you?
It's fun. Well, it was a time and a place. It was the late 80s. We were all young. Marijuana was, you know, ostensibly illegal, but I was in Eugene, Oregon. You know, it wasn't really illegal in Eugene. Hippie town. Okay. I don't know if you know Eugene. It's a hippie town. It's all right.
I've been to Oregon a couple times, but only where the Intel factories are.
Eugene was called for a long time the last refuge of the terminally hip, and it was full of co-ops, and it was a very, very crunchy town. It's called Blue Jean, and we were proud of it. Great marijuana, let me tell you.
Congratulations.
Now I sound like a stoner. No, it was back. Well, it's funny because, not to get into a disquisition on pot, but it was fun. I'm not really a drug user. It's not legal in Washington. I can talk about it openly, but there was a period of time, like pot's potency has gone up crazily in the last number of years as it was cultivated, you know, in greenhouses. In Eugene, people just grew pot outside, sometimes in their backyards. There wasn't really much enforcement. There was some, but it was sort of a casual thing. And as opposed to being, you know, grown overseas and imported or down in Humboldt County in California or something like that, we had locally grown pot and it was really good. There you go. Now you know.
You know, farm to table or...
Exactly. It was early. It was CSA pot.
Oh.
Not CSI pot, but CSA pot.
Well, okay.
Anyway, that's the reason I saw the film so many times. I swear. I'll stand by it.
This is a very circuitous path we're taking back to the body doubles and the sex.
That's right.
We'll come
back to that. So Connor's killed in this battle with the Kurgan.
And by killed, we mean somebody stabbed him in the stomach, which I guess back then would probably kill you. More sepsis would kill you than the actual sword wound, I would think.
Well, yeah, I mean, in the end, it's kind of the same thing at that point. It's not like you're going to be around a long time to make that distinction as you die on your deathbed in a couple minutes.
He got pale and, you know, fake died pretty quick.
Yeah. What I love about it is when he comes back and they're like, oh, you're possessed by the devil and let's just beat the crap out of you now. His
girlfriend is pretty harsh.
Yeah.
You know, she goes from, hey, I love this guy to like, nope, devil.
Burn him.
Kill him.
Yeah.
Burn the witch.
But
he turned me into a newt.
I got better.
But then he escapes off to live in exile with another life. And then somehow the Kurgan gave up on killing him in this time. And then Sean Connery heard wind of this through some grapevine or something. I don't know. And then
it almost sometimes seems like they have some sort of sixth sense. Like when they're near each other, they like sense or smell each other or something.
Oh, except that great scene at the zoo, which was terrible. It's one of the deleted scenes.
No reason. It was in there.
That was deleted. I'm watching this and I'm like, this is the worst thing. This is so ridiculous. The lions are growling. The Kurgan comes out of the shadows. Doop. Oh. Oh, and he doesn't sense him that time for whatever reason.
Yeah.
Doesn't everyone take their new friend to the zoo post-coitus?
Yeah, I don't know.
Maybe he was shopping for a new helmet. And so, well, I mean, I have problems with that, mainly for how they cut that for going from the sex montage to that. But as we said, we're leaving that for later. But back to this whole thing. Apparently, it had been some time that has passed where he started off his new life. And then Sean Connery, having heard wind of this, arrives from faraway Spain, which back then was technically far away, and then proceeds to pretend to be Spanish to the least of his abilities for a little bit and explain how the world works and dump him off a boat and the fish kilt thing and all that good stuff. And then the stag and all that weird everything.
Oh, my favorite part is when they're on the mountain and lightning is actually literally striking his hands. And it's like, what am I feeling? It's like, that's lightning striking your hands. And Connery says, it's the quickening, which makes no sense because the quickening doesn't make sense there because they were using it other times. I don't even know what it's supposed to mean. It's supposed to be like when they kill somebody, right?
I'm not even sure. Theoretically, it's supposed to be when they kill somebody. That's supposed to be the quickening. But he just says it there because there's lightning somebody drew on. So, I mean, but...
Maybe it's just like the sort of universal term, like the force or something.
It's also... Back to
it's
previous
the name
themes.
Of the sequel.
They hired a helicopter, and they were going to get used out of that helicopter, man. They were going to get used out of that helicopter.
Oh, absolutely.
We're going to have them up on some ridiculous places that they could never have climbed to do very bad with body doubles doing very bad sword fighting.
Oh, yeah. We haven't even addressed that yet. All of the sword fighting in this movie is atrocious.
Surprisingly bad. I forgot how bad it was.
Yeah. For a movie that's supposed to be about sword fighting, you would hope that it would like be better, but it's not even like I think there's better sword fighting in Star Wars, and that was like not even swords, and like, this is just sort of like clang clang, 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 explosion. And that's mainly where all the tension comes from, is some pyrotechnics that are going off in some car behind them, or building windows exploding or something like that. It's not really coming from the actual fighting. I'm not sure if they spent time choreographing the fights, or if they were just like, you know what would be cool? Hit that sword with that sword. Okay, cut. Okay, next one. We're going to set up the camera over here. Now hit that sword with that sword. Okay, cut. We're going to set up the camera over here. And then they just put it all together later.
That's the part of the slapdashness of it, right? Is that some parts obviously were set up very elaborately, and then some stuff is, and some of it's hilarious. Like when the Kurgan shows up to, for the Highlander, and they have he has the battle with Ramirez, and the whole castle is destroyed. That is a wonderful, totally campy, ridiculous thing, but it's supposed to be funny. I mean, like, he hits the blocks and the styrofoam falls off, you know, or like, I mean,
it explodes out of the world.
Well, and there's all the lightning going on, and it's ridiculous. And
the funniest part is, like, after he finally wins, he's standing up there, he's like, yep, that's right, I won, and then the stairs give way, and he's like, oh crap, and falls.
That was a weird fight. Then we get, like, sort of, I guess, a tearful goodbye to Ramirez. That was fast. Then we get, like, the, you know, grows old with her and she dies.
She looked pretty good for being that old, let me tell you.
Light a candle for me on my birthday.
Con every year, will you? Would you light a candle for Eva? The castle's destroyed. They built a little house. It's very sweet. Oh, yeah, because Ramirez has to do the more exposition about, you know, in the village scene where the kids run up and feel her up. That's a very funny, weird bit.
Yeah.
Oh, you rascals. As they're like, small children are feeling her up in the village. Like, okay. But, you know, she's buying chickens and there's guys bashing each other. In that fair, and but then Ramirez is doing, you must leave her. You must leave her because you cannot have children, and, you know, that whole thing.
Yeah. Well, it was a very strange part of it, too, the can't have children thing, apparently. And I was reading about this. Apparently, the first draft of the story, like, they could have kids, and he had, like, a great number of them and would watch them, like, grow old and die because they would wind up being mortal. But apparently that was changed to them not having any kids. Mm. So that was interesting.
We missed. There's one scene too that where he meets the Kurgan in the modern day. The Kurgan showed up, right? And he's at that crazy. The motel scenes were hilarious. Oh, that shot, that one, the one with Candy, that one. Now come on, with the sword and the assembly, and then she walks in. Now come on, that was great.
That was very strange, and I hope that the bruises they put on her arm were makeup, because that was weird.
Yeah. This is my sword. There are many like it, but this one is mine. Like, he's going through his whole routine of taking it out of the box and assembling it and spinning it around.
A snap together sword. It was pretty amazing.
That's pretty inventive.
The little spiky parts that flick out and make him blink. Those are hilarious.
Yeah, they frightened him. It's not like he's had hundreds of years to get used to it or anything.
The part of that is when he finds Nash and they fight at that, you know, whatever it is, like some abandoned mill in the middle of New York City. And the police helicopter shows up and they go running off. They say, wait, come back.
Stop running away. We're the police. You're not supposed to run away from us.
Like, wait, come back.
No, but the one shot in the hotel scene that I did want to point out, which I thought was good, particularly because they were just blatantly stealing, is they do that sort of low angle. And of course, I mean, the Kurgan's basically just dressed like the Terminator anyway. But they do a nice low angle kind of dolly away move when he, you know, right before he threatens the hotel owner and says, never speak to me again or whatever. And it's got like a Terminator kind of score behind it, too. It's a nice intimidating moment, even though it, again, is just the Terminator.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well... and there's the I have a question. So he has a scar on his neck.
Yeah.
But how do they have scars? Because they don't have scars from anything else that happens to them. And then how can you get a tattoo if that would also heal?
The neck. I was wondering if the neck was a special thing. That was my question. Because the neck got cut. And it's the only thing you see on anybody through the whole film. And I was like, oh, maybe that's special.
Well, it is their only weak point.
Yeah. Tattoos
are better. I'll give it to him.
Yeah, it's unclear how they heal. They did not have another Sean Connery film. They did not have a special healing scene where he's stabbed and then you pour Holy Grail water on it and heals and watch it heal. So many Sean Connery movies. But they don't show him ever healing. They just show him not dying, basically.
Yeah. Well, every time, like, Christophe Lambert is stabbed, etc., or when he dies and gets a gut wound and everything, like, they don't... He doesn't, like, have scars all over or anything.
No, you're right.
So that's the only reason why I wonder. But you're right. Maybe like around the neck is like a no healing zone. It's like a Achilles larynx or something. Like I don't know. Like that's the part where they were dipped in the river Styx and it didn't work out. Although it was sort of like tie dye or something. They put a rubber band around it. And so like. It was just weird when he was introduced with that affectation, as well as his gravelly voice, which is interesting. And there's what happened after this? Everything's just sort of blending together at this point.
I have a plot summary in front of me because otherwise we'd be lost. Heather dies, right? Yeah. We got to Heather dying, and. Oh, yeah, then there's the completely random introduction of Castagir, another immortal, clearly one of the last ones, and then the flashback to the 18th century for no good reason.
I hate that.
Yeah, that was sort of that was like time. It's like, I guess they needed to introduce somebody else so they couldn't go straight to the final battle, so they had to have like a little bit of a workaround there or something. I don't know.
Well, I like the bridge they met on. It's one of my favorite bridges in Central Park, but it's beautiful. It's... that's ridiculous that they met and they're just like, oh yeah, I guess the gathering's happening. Sup, we should throw a party.
It was a very large flask he pulled out too.
Which they didn't throw a party. He said, let's have a party, and then they don't have a party.
Yeah.
Well, maybe it was just a party at two.
Oh, good. We didn't see the party. I think there was supposed to be, I read somewhere, I think there was supposed to be a bar scene with them, like going nuts and fighting or something, like just doing stuff. So there actually was, they just didn't decide to do it. So they reference it and then they remove it, and the whole scene makes no sense.
Yeah, well,
they could have done some sort of like it's tradition for all of us to get together and have a big feast or what have you before the fighting and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
mm-hmm.
What was weird was the he also talks about how the last time they met was 100 years ago. Okay, so 1800s, right? But then he says, the last time we had a party was 1783 or whatever, 1786, and that didn't go well because I got so drunk that I got into that fight with that other guy.
Yeah.
And then we have the cut to that flashback that makes no sense. And then when we cut back from that, Castigar's nowhere to be found. He's no longer there. The next time we see him, he's fighting Kurgan for some reason. Somehow he was found and they fought. And he doesn't even have any dialogue there. He just... gets slew.
Also, like, black guy has a scimitar. Like, yeah, okay, thanks for the casual racism. That's great.
Yeah, well, I mean, this...
The Egyptian guy doesn't have a scimitar. He has a Japanese sword. All right, sorry.
It's not a great film.
All right.
At least we know who John Roderick would play in the remake of this movie.
That would be weird casting, Dan. But
weirder than this movie already has.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's not great. So I hate that whole scene with the British guy and he's drunk and then there's the stabbing and then he shoots the servant for
which
some
is
reason.
Not in the version I saw. And I watched it. I was like, what the hell is that about? It just seems so completely unnecessary.
Yeah. Like it makes no sense because especially the part where he shoots the servant and doesn't kill McLeod or anything or. Like, and the servant's very anxious about killing Connor, and then it's just like, but why would he be necessarily? None of that scene makes any sense.
He insulted his lady friend, and they were dueling to the death, and Connor wouldn't die, so he just apologized and ran away, and the other guy kept kissing him, and I guess he was fed up with that, so we shot him.
Is very weird.
It was very undignified. He shot him in the back. That's not how gentlemen duel.
Well, that servant guy was suggesting that he shoot the other guy in the back.
Oh, and then he shot him. Maybe it was because...
Yeah.
Oh.
But that doesn't make any sense, because it was just like, why were you so angry at him for suggesting that you shot him? Like, I don't know. But a whole slew of unimportant words could be written about all the things that were completely crazy about that part.
Oh. Oh, but there's also Rachel, who we haven't really talked about. She had mentioned before is like the version of the film that I saw a bazillion times. She's like, I can't figure out. You're like, maybe you love her. She's aged. Is maybe she's longed for him. And, you know, it seemed like unrequited. Then they put in the scene, which totally creeped me out, that he rescued her as a small child. And now she's like in her 50s or something. And it's like, so he rescued her as a child. And at some point they became lovers. Is that what's going on?
I thought he was just sort of like the father figure taking care of her.
Maybe. Yeah. I don't know. Well, I think I may be colored by having seen the film without the... So the Nazi scene where he rescues her is not in the version I saw. And then there's a couple other bits with her where they talk, a couple things she says that aren't in it. So she's given like actually enough of a story to understand who she is in this alternate or the longer version.
Yeah. Well, I mean, from what I was watching... When we first saw her, I was like, okay, so maybe it's a former lover or something. But then once we had the scene where we established that they knew each other from back then, and then later on when she's sort of reprimanding him on how he should really, you know, go find somebody, you know, to like love in real life or something, it does sort of seem more like she's did not ever have a relationship like that with him.
I guess you're right. That is less creepy when you put it that way. But she has a somewhat more significant part in this. I mean, but for no particular reason either. Giving her some backstory doesn't actually help tell the story.
No, her entire job in the movie is just to say, I'm sorry he's not available right now.
Yes.
That's true. It's very nice of her. Nice of her to do that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, she's going to make a sizable fortune from doing that. So it's not a bad job.
I also like, by the way, one of the other new lines, which this is so many funny things. When he pulls out the 1783, coincidence, brandy at her apartment, she says, wow, that's old. That's her line. I almost lost it because that is not, that one line was stuck in there. The rest of the scene is the same. Like,
yeah.
Okay.
I really want to know if brandy from 1783 is actually drinkable. Like,
I don't know.
I would have to assume that it would taste disgusting. It doesn't really seem like you can age things for a really long time, but 1783, that's a while.
it might not even have been like a brand new bottle. It's like just what he had left over from the party. So he just took it with him. It had an open bottle for that many years.
Oh, so is he had like a maybe a little vacuum wine stopper in it?
Yeah, you know? Yeah, he just recorked it.
Yes.
Oh, people will pay. I'm finding people will buy 200-year-old cognac, but I don't know if they'll drink it.
Yeah, that's the thing. Is like I don't know if they'll drink it either because I was recently on a champagne tour and people will buy old bottles of champagne that are not drinkable anymore or old bottles of wine, just because they want to collect things that are old and like the old label and all that. But then it's never consumed because it would taste terrible.
And isn't there a Tom Selleck movie where he buys a bottle of Napoleon's wine and opens it and drinks it?
Oh.
I don't remember that.
It's a plot point in some stupid, terrible movie that I've seen on TV.
Tom Selleck movies. Now that's a category of film. Is it My Bodyguard? Is it the only thing with Paulina, whatever?
No idea. I don't think it's Mr. Baseball. Maybe it's something I just made up. Who knows?
Wow. Was
Mr. Baseball and Tom Selleck? Anyway.
Dan.
Suddenly I feel very old.
No, it's that... Well, not necessarily that you're old, because I also got the reference to Mr. Baseball. It's just
that's pretty good.
I would not make a reference to Mr. Baseball. So,
well,
congratulations,
clearly that is why I am here still on this show.
For those important moments.
So that Joe isn't talking to himself? That would also be...
you know, he brings up all of the actors who were in Star Trek, and I say stupid things about Tom Selleck.
Yep.
Her Alibi, that's the movie I'm thinking of, 1989. Paulina Porizkova and Tom Selleck. The most beautiful woman of her time, and this guy with a mustache.
Big mustache. He had a Ferrari in that one show.
I heard that.
A Hawaiian shirt. It was red.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. That's Phil Michaels' favorite show, I think.
Yes.
okay. So the computer guy. So yes. I've just been... Now, listen to the thing. I spent months working on this story about computer vision and robotics for The Economist. And so I learned a lot about machine learning and deep learning and convolution filters. It was very interesting. And I'm watching this movie and I'm like, the technique he's using was not available until a few years ago. And so it was fascinating that someone had visualized and then like animated. I mean, that was probably hand animation or something, right? I remember they had some computer, maybe a computer. You know, the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy TV show. You guys ever seen that? The original one?
Mm-mm. No.
It's got fascinating animation that looks like really amazing early CG. It's very pretty and it looks computer animated. It was all done by hand because it couldn't be done by a computer. So they put an enormous amount of time in. And I have a feeling, I don't know, maybe this was somebody wrote a program to do this, probably so by 1986, I'm sure. But the actual computational effort involved was simply the machine learning required to do what that guy did is like a technique from like 2005. And I just love that someone thought of it. It's like, well, what if we had, it would recognize and superposition and it would do, it's like, awesome. You were ahead of your time. Whoever thought
it's,
that.
It's, you know, life imitating art or vice versa, as they say.
Yeah, this is like the cell phones in Star Trek and iPads in 2001 A Space Odyssey. Speaking of movies where they didn't have computer animation, all of the graphics in 2001 A Space Odyssey were hand-drawn.
Oh, man, it's amazing.
And that's why all of those animators... Next project was to work on a Yellow Submarine. So,
oh my God, that's hilarious! That's great.
But before we leave the computer scene, there are a couple notable things about this that we should point out. One, the fact that she puts on a jacket and says it's cold in here, and the guy says, "You know, you can't have any heat because it disagrees with the circuits." Which,
whatever. Very nice.
Aside from the fact that it's an open air office with just like an 8-foot partition between the computer section and then the rest of the folks, but. You can tell from the flooring and kind of the way they set up that like half wall of glass windows and doors that they shot that in the same church where Connor has his little conversation with the Kurgan later.
Oh, and that's great.
They just cleared everything out and restaged it as an office. But you can clearly see like the marble pillars, you know, down the side of the walls there. And it's like, well, this is a very interesting, odd office. And then they get to the church scene later. And it's like, oh, they're just reusing locations. That's nice.
Yeah. Oh, nice. It was also a very cavernous office. But the thing I thought was funny about it is that he is totally on board with an immortal person from the past who has repurposed his property from fake inheriting it all of this time. Like that, he is 100% behind this theory, and she's like, no, that there can't be because that doesn't seem rational at all. Of course he's right, but the fact that he just makes that leap and is so certain of it is I think quite unintentionally hilarious because there's no reason for it at all.
That guy's been going to the World Science Fiction Conference or convention since it was founded, just about, gotta say. Pretty sure, right? So it was funny though. It was like, well, it's also, you're in a film that's ostensibly like, no, they never decided on the realism of the film, right? Like, there's magic in it, but it's unclear whether anybody believes in magic or not. Maybe not. So no one can expect it. But then you have this guy who's like, he must have lived for hundreds of years and he just accepts it. But so in a non-magical world, that would just be, you know, they'd be like, no, somebody's pulling some kind of scam, is what you'd say.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that is her response, is that, you know, that's not possible. Like, she plays, like, the rational audience member part, although, at this point in the movie, we, as the audience, are completely on board with the fact that there are immortals in the film.
She plays the rational part right up to the point where she stabs him and then cries and has sex with him.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Is it time to talk about the sex?
Let's get down to it.
Even as like an 18-year-old in 1987 or so, right? 18, 19 years old, I found this the least erotic thing I've ever seen. And rewatching it, I have the same reaction. It is, you know,
But it's shot in silhouette.
It's body doubles.
What could you possibly want?
Body doubles doing it, of course, because Christoph Lambert and Roxanne Hart did not sign any waivers to do sex scenes. And it's just, it is, and then, oh, there's more of the sex in this version, by the way, not that it makes it more erotic. It's like, it moves. The one I saw is pretty chaste. Like there's a little bit of boob action that you see and so forth. This one, you're like, all right, we're moving like crossing that line into softcore, you know, pornography. It's going in Showtime here late at night. It was very funny, but it was so completely like I'm watching going, oh, no.
No.
There were a lot of films in that era, though, where there was like one really stupid, awful sex scene, sometimes with nudity, usually with body doubles, in that period of time. There's a movie called, Glenning. So the movie How to Beat the High Cost of Living was made in my hometown of Eugene, Oregon, as was Stand By Me and Personal Best and a bunch of other films. Eugene attracted certain movies. How to Beat the High Cost of Living had some great actors and actresses of the time. My mom met Mike Farrell, you know, from MASH, because he was there because he was dating Susan St. James, who was in it. And who's the one from Kate and Ally from SNL? Jane Curtin was in it as well. And so it's this terrible film about people like trying to steal money from some kind of thing. It's a ridiculous film. But there's one bit where, to distract attention, Jane Curtin, I think, whips off her top and is like nude, right? From the top up. And it is the worst scene in the film because, such as the worst scene, it's a terrible film, because she's trying to get attention. And at that point, she's a 40-year-old woman probably then or something like that. And it cuts to neck down shot of boobs, clearly on a much younger, like a 20-year-old, for a moment or so, or however long they needed to establish the scene. It's wonderful. So that was earlier in the 80s, but that's the kind of movies that were made when I was a youth. They had a little bit of really terrible extraneous nudity not involving the people in the film.
I'm glad that that somehow related to your life.
Yeah, see, my only points of reference for sort of like these terrible silhouetted love scenes are, I don't know, there's like Top Gun and like Risky Business or something, but that's about all I got. And I don't know why those are both Tom Cruise movies. Apparently when I see silhouetted terrible sex scenes from the 80s, just reminds me of Tom Cruise.
Oh, and they're so slow, too. Like, I really wonder if someone thought that this was, like, sensuous or something.
I don't
know. This is so erotic, just watching nothing happening.
I think the reason it wasn't very effective is I don't recall there being any saxophone playing.
Oh, that's it. You're totally right. Did they play Queen music behind it? I can't even remember.
Yeah, it was an orchestral version of Who Wants to Live Forever. So there was no vocals from Freddie Mercury, and it was just like all strings.
Sidebar here, by the way. Sidebar. Freddie Mercury loved this movie, apparently. Like this, because he was supposed to do one, or Queen was supposed to do one song for this film, and they just kept writing music, and they wouldn't stop. And they wrote like 8 songs for this movie. And I didn't realize that some of the songs that I think of as Queen songs originated in the film. I thought they were from other, they were repurposed.
Which ones were original for the film?
Oh, now you're going to ask me that and I don't have it to hand. But there's, I read this in the, some of the background thing. There's, let's see if I find it. But
honestly, I would be surprised that any of these were original to the film. Because I would have expected them to be just ported over from a Queen album.
Well, that's what I thought, too. I'm trying to remember. Oh, wait, here we go. Let's see. Because they, Princes of the Universe was written for Highlander.
Yeah, Princes of the Universe.
There are 8 Queen songs in here?
Give me the prize, Kurgan's theme. And the album version, unfortunately, includes snippets of dialogue from the film, which is one of the things I don't like about the Flash Gordon soundtrack. As I wish they had just done the music.
Mm-hmm.
random sidetrack. 1 Year of Love. Don't Lose Your Head, Who Wants to Live Forever, and A Kind of Magic. And they also went on to be released on A Kind of Magic album.
Oh, that's it. Okay, yeah. So it did come out. So it is a Queen album, sort of, but I was surprised. I mean, they composed original stuff for this. So Freddie Mercury, it sounds like, you read a few accounts here and there, like he really liked I don't know if he saw it shot, obviously, but the script, or maybe the director really got him excited about it. But this was his Tommy, let's say.
Yeah.
We won't hold it against him.
and the theme from New York, New York, and Hammer to Fall, which is a Queen song that predated the film. Were also in the movie, but not on the album A Kind of Magic that came out after.
I see. The film isn't over yet, is it? We're still...
No.
Where are we at here? Wait, so...
Well, this Heather's... is my favorite part of the sex scene. After the really boring part, we cut immediately to the lion.
It's metaphorical.
That was great. That was great.
It's one of those things where it's just like a jump cut to like scare you. Like you're watching some tranquil thing and then all of a sudden a scary face comes on. It's just like, what? Like, why did you do that? Like, we went from, like, your idea of what is sexy to a lion roaring.
They had to reset the tone. They had to take it down a notch or two.
Yeah, well, the best way to reset your tone is a hard reset. You gotta zap the tone RAM.
The lion scene isn't in there, the zoo scene. So they have sex, and then it immediately cuts to her carrying books back to her apartment and the Kurgan being there for some reason. You know, we don't know how he followed, but it's like, all right, he knows how to follow people, so he found her.
He's an amazing detective sometimes, on occasion. Very seldomly.
I had a hard time holding things against him. I mean, he's violent and cruel, but he really, you know, he gets into it. He celebrates it. He's committed, is the thing. That scene, the thing where he, you know, jumps into the car and he's driving and he's like, all the green screen of people being, you know, knocked over the car and then getting on the side. Oh, that was actually, I thought, a really great thing is, like, you know, there's all the terror and he's going between, he's playing chicken. He knocks the motorcyclist off and the person flies in the air. Then there's a bit where she just passes out from, like, fear. She slumps and he's just driving. There's no sound, just driving on a bridge on the sidewalk part, and sparks are flying on both sides. I thought that was a good shot. I like that.
Mm-hmm. It was a legitimately terrifying scene. It went on for a very long time, but it was good.
Yeah, well, you also got a Clancy Brown going, New York, New York, which is, you know, great.
Sing with me. Sing
along. He's got a nice maniacalness to him. So, of course, Castigere was killed, and the Vietnam vet saw it.
That was weird.
It was very weird. They seemed to play it for comedy, which seemed inappropriate and really...
Random man driving around with an Uzi on his passenger seat?
Yeah, well, but also just the way they also followed up the scene later to explain what had happened. And they're talking about how, you know, he had fought in Vietnam and stuff like that. And it's just like, well, then you guys aren't playing like a lot of... you guys are playing this like for laughs, which is gross. Like, it's not like a funny thing that the guy can't deal with life.
Like, oh, he's got a couple screws loose, but he's a good guy. You know, PTSD is hilarious, isn't it?
Yeah, that is not right. But I got a question. In that scene where the cops are talking to him, and then right before they're going to leave the room, he's like, I got to say one more thing. And then they like cut to that shot from outside of the thing and he's talking, but we are hearing the intercom, and then they cut back to inside. And I was just like, what happened? Like, did he say something we weren't supposed to hear? And it's not like it's a secret, because it never comes to play a part in the movie ever again. Like, was he just like cursing them out and they didn't want to change the rating on the film?
No, he was telling them about the Kurgan, the energy showing up and like people floating and crap. Like, but this gets to that, like, who is the proxy for the audience thing. Again, it's like, we know that we just saw the scene, and then you're presenting it as if it's a mystery to the police, and you're excluding information from us from being obvious to what end. And then, as you point out, we never see the police again. That's it. Or those guys. Mm-hmm. We never see those guys again.
Yeah, well, I
will put $20 down on the table saying that the reason they did it that way is because his explanation took a really long time and they wanted to get on with it because, like you said, we already knew that part, so they just cut the dialogue out, put in some background noise, and then they just cut his speech short.
I don't even know why they bothered to have any of that. Whatever. Like, they could have cut the entire hospital scene out and then just had them at the weird hot dog vendor scene.
But the police weird needed to know gravity of the situation so they could then do nothing in the movie.
Did you notice this in the hot dog scene? The bald cop does not have a hot dog in his bun.
Yes, I did notice that. Maybe he's just a fan of, like, mustard and sauerkraut, because it was just, like, bun-colored, so like, I assume maybe there was something on there.
He was just squeezing mustard and thing, and I'm like, I got high def now. I can see that. You can see there's no hot dog.
On a carb-only diet or something.
Oh, my God. You would never have known the old days. The resolution would have been high enough to see that there was no hot dog in the bun.
Oh. That's a problem for a lot of people. But,
But that was good.
No, but the... So they have he's got to go fight the Kurgan now after he got the answering machine message.
He has a very large answering machine.
How young are you all? That was the miniature version.
I'm familiar with answering machines, but it was like the size of my laptop.
That was, I'm going to tell you, that was a special model. It had the, That was not. It was a little out of date. By 1986, you could get one that was more compact.
That was back when they used full-size cassettes, wasn't it?
You had to put an 8-inch disc into it, and you need a big enough slot. No, I don't know.
Oh.
Reel-to-reel answering machines. Now that, those were the days.
I mean, at that point, it's basically just a Naga recorder. It's not really an answering machine.
No, well, I mean, it's just weird that he went through all the trouble to find out where he lives and get his phone number and call and leave a message.
Oh, he's probably in the yellow pages or whatever.
I never realized that. That's actually, that never struck me as an issue. Right, of course you could find, it's like, he was a good detective, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Or maybe he got the phone number from Brenda.
Yeah, it could be. Yeah, that's true.
Maybe, but the strategy doesn't make a lot of sense in terms of, like, if he wanted to kill him at any point in this film, he could have killed him. But, I mean, maybe it is, like, he wants to torture him and extract maximum value out of this kill or something.
Well, they're honorable men. They have to meet on the battlefield. He can't just, like, sneak up behind him and cut his head off.
He's
that
not an honorable man. He's just kidnapped somebody.
he's psychotic, but when it comes to the prize, he wants to win it the old-fashioned way. Or, I don't know.
Nobody's ever won it before, so there's no old-fashioned way to win it.
Holy ground, Tom and Highlander.
Actually, so this is one question I have about this whole plot about winning the prize, and then suddenly, you know, part of the prize is he gets this whatever weird telepathy thing, and he also becomes mortal and can have kids again. Is this the kind of thing that, like, cycles through? Like, is there a new cycle of immortals that will be born around the world, and then they will eventually fight, and one of them will win the prize in a couple centuries?
I have good news for you. When we talk about the rest of the films,
please don't tell me that that's what this. Please don't tell me that that's what happens.
We'll get to that.
Oh God!
Don't worry, we're not going to talk about the other four films in any depth at all. But I learned some things in researching for this episode.
It's worth a cursory mention, but the premise of the second one is
terrible.
Is John Polito in any of the other ones?
Is who?
John Polito, the detective, the bald detective.
Oh, the bald
detective.
No, he's great.
The Seamus Monk from Big Lebowski.
Oh. See, great character actors.
Your brother Seamus, sorry, Irish Monk. God, I get the line wrong.
It's riddled with excellent actors. Well, let's see. Wait, so hold on. We got the, the Kurgan is, where are we at? The Kurgan hasn't killed, so he's kidnapped her.
Yeah, he leaves the message.
He told Rachel, everything's yours, all the paperwork's done, I'm splitting, you're not coming back even if you win. He's like, nope,
I'm power of attorney and what have you, because that's very important.
I did like the Silver Cup scene. I think that was just so, like, grand opera, you know, it was ridiculous and big and sort of, I don't know, it was fun.
I like that they built all of that inside a soundstage somewhere, especially when the explosions go off and you can see the light illuminate the cyclorama backdrop thing back there.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
It's like that painting of the sky is like 2 feet behind where the building is. it's pretty entertaining. But they went through a lot of trouble blowing that up and the pyrotechnics for it and the water from the water tower collapsing. Yeah. They really... It's one of those things where it's surprisingly uneven how many times they think out something like really hard and focus on it and then like leave all of this other stuff completely.
Yeah, the water tower and then the crashing through the skylight, and that gives them this great stage on which to have that final battle that's terrific. And it's like, I mean, that when her, you know, she's being the damsel in distress, but ultimately she's the one who rescues herself. They're fighting. So she practically falls off the building, climbs back up and tries not to get electrocuted and winds up, you know, down there with them. I thought that was actually pretty, it was pretty good.
Yeah. It's like, gee, thanks for coming to my rescue as I almost fall off the top of this building.
Exactly. The reason that scene seemed way too long. And they added more in there too. The whole bit with them underwater and whatever, that was cut from the version I saw. It was much at the shorter cut that happens all very quickly.
Yeah.
There's probably a really good, like, 45-minute version of this movie.
Oh, yeah, it could be really snippy.
I thought you were about to say a really good version that's also 45 minutes longer. And I was going to be like, no, not possible.
No, not longer.
Well, there's all this exposition.
Oh, good Lord.
There's a lot more mud and Scottish village to talk about.
Well, what was really funny is that one scene where he somehow loses him on the rooftop in the water and does the spinning under the water thing where he slowly starts spinning down and spinning with his blade out so that if he's under the water, he'll hit him. And then he disappears completely underneath the surface. And then, like, 2 seconds later, they're back fighting again. It's just like, somebody saw was sitting there and was like, I got this really cool idea for a shot, Clancy. I want you to do this. Okay, great. We got it. All right, now go back to the other stuff. doesn't need to connect with anything. Just do it.
Nah, he's just kind of a wackadoodle character. He's fighting, but he's fighting with insane style.
Yeah, I suppose. And so then they have the final fight in the much cheaper room that only has the windows behind them.
And more importantly, is properly rigged so he can fly up in the air and spin around.
Yes. And so they have their fight in there. Again, not great sword stuff. I mean, it's not He-Man Masters of the Universe bad, but it's not great.
Not good. Well, also the whole bit, like, I think they missed, this is one of the things where I think the film was inexpertly made at this point, only at this point. This is what got me about Zardoz, as you remember, is they had so many opportunities to make that film much more interesting and better, and at every turn you're thinking this could be interesting, and like, no, it's not. So in Highlander, there's a lot of moments where, again, if it had been streamlined and there'd been a little more explanation and a little less explanation, it could have been better. Here you're like, oh, the whole point is he's almost killed, but Brenda saves him. He would have been killed, and this is why he needed somebody else's life. It's a theme, but because they didn't build this as a theme and it's sort of just mentioned by Rachel, it doesn't become, you know, and she's also already done it. Rachel or Brenda already earlier hit the Kurgan with a pipe in that earlier scene when they first meet. So it lacks the impact. But I think the whole idea is like, no, the prize would have gone to the Kurgan and there'd been, you know, an age of darkness, except that, you know, she happened to be there because he trusted and fell in love with her.
Yeah,
but, well, but they didn't do that.
Maybe the shadow monster thing that comes out of the Kurgan could have explained all that to him.
I don't know that what was that's true about. Love.
You mean the like the anime doodles?
Yeah.
Yeah. What the hell was that? What?
It was so weird. Apparently, he wanted it to be a dragon. The director wanted it to be a dragon, but it had to be cut for time.
There was a lot of just menacing faces with like pointy teeth, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was weird because it was sort of like had like a Klingon forehead predator thing going on, and then like a lot of sharp teeth, and then it was like some skull things that were flying out. It was just like all kinds of random stuff. They're just like, draw some stuff. They gave it to like 10 different people. They're like, just draw whatever you want.
Well, it was all very like negative and evil seeming too. And I'm like, why would he? So he's getting all this power, and it's all like demons. Is that what we're learning? It's demon power. Does that make sense?
My favorite part is while all this nefarious stuff that we're seeing is happening, and all the explosions are still going on, and there's lightning and the demon faces and stuff, we're hearing him say how great all of this is and how he can see everything and know everything, et cetera, in a voiceover. So presumably we don't think he's dying. They felt like it was probably a good idea to explain to the audience that this was a good thing. And once that all concludes, then all of a sudden we're in Scotland for more voiceover and more explanation about the prize that he has.
Yeah. So first, did you guys see the exploding mannequin head?
Yes.
That was just the worst. I mean, it's they don't even try to like make it a one frame. It's just, you actually have a moment to look at it. You're just like, and there's an exploding mannequin head. Like what? I mean, it's just obviously a mannequin head. It was great.
No, it, There is not a lot of subterfuge when it comes to what things are. Like when Clancy's head is coming off and they have it sort of start to separate. It's like you can very clearly see the bulging appliance from his neck where this is supposed to separate. Because that's how you had to do things back then. You had to build out a neck so that it could break apart. Only the problem is if you don't put the camera in such a place that you have a forced perspective to make it look like it's not a giant bulging tumor in his neck, then the effect is given away. So they didn't do that. They basically shot it straight on and you could see this giant bulge from it splitting open. And it's just like, it's not great, guys. I don't really like the way that they did the I don't know if it's an anime first thing or if it's more like anime in the 90s did this, but the whole like two people run at each other with swords and slash, and then you cut to them both sort of okay, and then like somebody slowly slides apart.
That was in Rob Roy also. There's a bit where Liam Neeson like slices Tim, what's his face? Tim, I can't think of the actor's name, in half practically, and this Tim Roth. He like runs by him and just like sort of just runs a sword all the way down his middle. And that's, That's around. That's a little bit later. Rob Roy is the 90s. I'm sure. 1995.
Okay. Well, Liam Neeson should have brought that lesson with him to Star Wars Episode One.
Yeah.
But Ewan McGregor sliced Darth Maul in half there.
Oh my gosh, you're right. And Rob Roy takes place in the Highlands of Scotland in the 1700s. So it all comes together.
They also did that same run past each other and slice each other in half thing in Predators, the most recent one where they all go to Predator Planet and die.
Ugh. Okay. So
that last scene. Oh, so watching the last scene, I remember the last scene being bad, but I'm like, oh my God, is that the most awkward thing in the world? It's voiceover and it cuts to them staring. Isn't that the most painful thing you ever saw? The two of them staring into each other's eyes was awful.
It's atrocious because it's just like we have just a bunch of random stuff. We sent like, I don't know, a third unit assistant director out to Scotland for like 5 minutes.
Right.
And just to record like a car on a road and like a jet plane for a reason.
Well, that's how you can tell it's modern times. Yeah, exactly. They're in Scotland again, but there's a jet.
There's a jet, a power line, and a car.
Right.
That's how you know it's the future.
Sure.
So they have that. And then, of course, they have them sitting on some grass.
Show.
Yeah, they have them sitting on some grass.
Or are they sitting on some heather?
Oh, Glenn, I hope you're happy. I hope you're proud of yourself, Glenn.
You'd think I saved that up, but that just came to me this moment.
Okay, so grass or heather. And so they're not speaking to each other in dialogue on camera. It is just a shot of them, like if it's some sort of like commercial for Valtrex or something. And then there's the voiceover that's been going this whole time explaining to her things, and like Sean Connery having some voiceover moments. And he's all like, oh, you never told me about this, you piece of haggis. And
I love his little nickname for him came through all the way at the end. You little haggis, you little buddy.
It's the
dumbest thing.
Prize kind of sucks, doesn't it? It's like, what are you going to do with it? It's like, I can help people understand each other.
I'm going to use it to learn tomorrow's lottery numbers. That's probably what I'm going to do.
Yeah. Or you don't even need the almanac, really, if you want to rule the future. But
actually, it's telepathy, so you can't, like, you can just hear what people are thinking. It's basically, the sequel to this should be What Women Want.
Oh, my God.
Oh my God, Mel Gibson is not the Highlander.
The Highlander.
Oh God, he is. He's in Braveheart.
Exactly.
No.
Oh, Braveheart is the prequel to the Highlander. The sequel is
at the end. He's killed, but he's not really killed at the end of Braveheart. They take his body off, and he's like, "What's going on here? I'm immortal."
Oh.
Oh my God. So okay, I like this retcon. We go from Braveheart to Highlander to What Women Want. That's our sequence of films here.
God. Then we close it out with some Queen music, and then that's the end.
Or is it? You guys loved it then. This is great.
It was a movie.
I like the cheesiness of it. I, honestly, like having obviously never seen this before in my life after some reflection, I like the cheesiness of it. I wouldn't possibly recommend that anyone that is really interested in a good sword fighting movie go watch this, or
you kind of need to see it just for the tropes going forward in cinema, just to see, you know, the references to it, just what came out of this. But other, like, it's not a great movie.
Yeah, I would lump this with like Hellraiser or something, where it's just like campy, like kind of cheesy, unintentionally humorous in places.
Yeah.
That's the sort of thing, and you know, very 80s, of course. And this sort of thing was the style at the time. So
that's right. I put an onion in my hat then too. Exactly.
Yeah, it's the good stuff, I think, necessarily, that some people live on, and then it's the other stuff that people necessarily shove away from them. Mixed bag.
It's a good, I think, actually, so I would say, having grown up during that time, I think it's a really, it's a fun slice of what people thought culture was then that they encoded into a film. And the Queen music, I think without the Queen music, I think if there's a lesser soundtrack, it would be a lot less appealing. Like, it's sort of fun and campy. And I think if they had just hired, you know, Joe down the street, not you, Joe, different Joe, they would be, you'd just be kind of like, eh, it's all right, you know. But I think just having that, like, edge of like, oh my God, this is Queen. Holy cow. Okay, that's good.
Yeah, because, like, Michael came in score, which you can hear him do stuff on occasions in this film.
Yeah.
It's fine, but it's, like, perfectly forgettable. Queen's music, I think, pushes it over the edge, like you're saying. So that I think, is better.
Here's another great fact that I just discovered. I did not know. I was scrolling through the Wikipedia page to find the cutscene thing. Did not know this. This was written as a class assignment in the screenwriting program at UCLA, and then he got it optioned.
Oh my God.
And here's the quote. He was apparently traveling through Scotland on a summer vacation. He was standing in front of a suit of armor, and he wondered, what would it be like if that guy was alive today?
So there. And that's how a movie was before. Oh my God. You know, this makes perfect sense as a writing exercise for a film school.
Mm-hmm.
With regard to this being sort of a reflection of the culture at the time, I have to ask you, because I don't personally have any recollection of the time. Huh. Was this following the trend or creating the trend of the sort of the tan trench coat thing going on?
Oh, I think it was definitely a trend. You had a lot of brooding characters in movies and TV wore trench coats.
Mm. Okay, yeah. Because that kind of became a thing for a little while.
Yeah, yeah. That's what is that film? It's the TV series. I don't remember where I thought the Fazil was the guy. It's it's driving me crazy. It's a guy who's like he like helps people obtain revenge. Like he finds them and then he like hires himself to them and he gets them to obtain revenge. But this was anyway. It was from the 1980s, but he wore a trench coat.
Okay.
If you're into revenge and killing, you wear trench coats. It's just very handy. You can hide lots of stuff in them, like apparently like full-size swords that no one can see.
Do you think Columbo had a sword under his jacket?
One more thing, man. I got a Peter Falk story, but I won't tell it. Not about it.
Go ahead.
You can't Falking tease us.
All right. It's Falking. Falking Glenning. So old housemate of mine. His father grew up in the same town Peter Falk did. And Falk was kind of, you know, he didn't make much of himself until he was actually older, like his 30s or something like that. And he's an older guy. And he was still kicking around the house. So my friend said that his grandfather told his father, you need to make something of yourself, not like that Peter Falk guy. It's pretty good. Like he was actor studio days or something like that before he became, you know, who he was. So this, you know, this movie did so well in that it tanked at the box office. As we talked about earlier, they made a bunch of sequels.
Yeah. What I like about the sequel, because I was briefly refreshing my memory on Highlander 2, which I think I've seen more of, although I can't recall any of the things I was reading in the Wikipedia article other than the basic summory.
Oh, my God. I think there's more lightning in Highlander 2. That's all I remember.
Highlander 2 is possibly one of the worst films I've ever seen. And in fact, I think one of the background things I was reading said that it is regarded by many people as one of the worst films ever made.
Yeah.
And I can't really deny that.
What I love about it is, like, apparently it was made in Argentina. The government collapsed. Not the government collapsed. The economy tanked. And the investors in the film took over the project from the director, Russell Mulcahy.
Who was the
director of the first one. So he got shoved out of putting it together because he had shot most of it. And so they put it together how they thought it should go. And he apparently has some renegade cut where he put it together how he thought it should go and like relabeled some of the scenes to be like different stuff. Like instead of, before saying what he changed, we should probably just mention, Glenn, do you want to share the summary?
Yes, I do. Because I remember watching this. So Heitlio, it's not Zardoz. Let's put it that way. Zardoz is insane. Like, you can often not really believe what you're seeing in the movie because it's so ridiculous. And it's trying to be outre and, you know, whatever. So Zardoz is like on one pole. Highlander 2 is just bad. Like, they retcon everything. So in Highlander 2, the idea is that Connor, it opens, Connor's old now, he's aged, the world has got surrounded by, he's trying to solve the ozone problem, and they built this shield around the Earth to block the sun, and now it's heating up the Earth, and so it's sort of sci-fi future, it's the year, I don't know, 2024, humanity is collapsing, there's some giant corporation that runs the Earth, and then we cut to another planet, the planet Zeist, that apparently all the immortals came from. We never really learned about, and they just retcon left and right. And Sean Connery is resurrected on a during a stage play because Connor thinks about him real hard, and he comes back. Remember, if you ever need me, you just have to think about me hard enough and I'll come back and help you or something. There's some terrible dialogue. And so Connor, I need you, Ramirez. And he comes back. And then there's some crazy like hoverboard thing where Connor kills somebody, one of the other aliens. They come to kill him. And then he becomes immortal and young again. And It does have I do like Virginia Madsen. She's, you know, not her fault that this happened.
not her fault.
She tried.
All I can mostly remember are the sky shots where they replaced all the skies with the roiling like cloud tank stuff. Like it's not good. And at the end when the shield spoiler alert. I don't want to spoil the movie.
Oh yes,
but just the effects of the ending are not good either, and very bad. And so that is a weird film. And isn't there like somebody who has like a jetpack with wings on it at some point? And Michael Ironside is in it, which is amazing because I love Michael Ironside as his campy self.
I can't even remember what his role. Is in there, and there's this whole thing where they're like in some supermax prison where the shield generator is. It becomes and like Connery puts himself under the shield thing and like absorbs all its power and dies again, but they were able to shut the shield. It's not good. It's not good.
It sounds like Total Recall fanfic, if I'm honest.
It's like super retcon. But the director, yeah, to his credit, he did not make exactly this. And apparently the Renegade cut makes more sense. But I can't believe it's good. But
no. At least well, supposedly instead of being aliens, they were supposed to be from some Earth civilization that lived long ago, like Atlantis or something. They went into decline or whatever, and that's where they came from.
Not
another planet. That doesn't necessarily make it better, but it's just different.
It does not. And then there's Highlander 3, which I refuse to see. It looked horrible. There's like some immortal was hidden away, and so he was revived or something, and then he has to fight, and apparently it's very much like the first film. And then, they made a TV series, which I used to watch. The Highlander TV series was actually, I found kind of amusing. It was very unevenly written and acted, to say the least.
Yeah. It was like every episode is basically self-contained, and like it was mostly like flashbacks, and then they'd like cut back to whatever was happening in the day where mostly no action was happening, and then sometimes there was a fight at the end, but not very often because those were expensive. So it was not a great television series. I don't have fond recollections of it, but it is something that I definitely have recollections of.
I watched some of it. It was inoffensive at the time when we couldn't get TV on demand as easily, and you'd turn something on and I don't know, guys, remember this? But you turn on the television, programs would happen.
That was that loud knob that you turned that made the clicky noises. Exactly. in the UHF.
Click. That's what you moved the rubber the rabbit ears, not rubber ears. That's a whole different thing. the rubber ears and TV appeared. So then there's like a Highlander 4. And Highlander 5. And so the thing is, reading the description, Highlander 5 has some kind of asinine explanation of like. The source, they like trace, where the immortal source comes from, and then they have to kill people, get killed.
Is it midichlorians?
It's sadly no. It would be much better.
Aww.
It's some kind of dopey thing, and that involves Adrian Paul, involves the Duncan MacLeod character from the TV series. So that's pretty
well. Cool. That's because in the fourth one they meet Lambert and Adrian Paul meet, and they're somehow supposed to be related. And they do stuff and things, and there's a sacrifice, and then that's I just can't believe like that it sustained itself for all of this. It progressively just keeps declining over time, and every iteration retcons all of the previous iterations, but just like cherry pick some thing they want to carry forward. Usually so, actors.
I got a couple good Connery bits that are related to this, though, which I got to share. Because one is Mystery Science Theater 3000 years ago, when it was still being broadcast new, they did an episode about a movie called Operation Kid Brother, which has different names, also called OK Connery. And it's Sean Connery, actually his brother, Neil, who was not really an actor. Did movie
Neil Connery?
Neil Connery. You'd think I'm making this up. I told Jason Snell this, and he thought I was making it up. But he looks at it. He's like, "Oh my god!" And they basically, it's sort of like a Casino Royale parody of James Bond, but then it's also sincere. And so, in the movie, the Neil Connery character's name is what is he called? Even he's supposed to be like James Bond's brother, and they don't ever. Mention his name, but it's just his character's name is Dr. Neil Connery. Neil Connery is the actor's name, and the character's name is Dr. Neil Connery, and he's a hypnotist. And his incredible hypnotic powers, and it's this crazy.
Wait, you got a doctorate in hypnotism?
He's a cosmetic surgeon who also happens to be an amazing hypnotist.
Cosmetic surgeon.
This is a movie that opens with one of the other. It's a Bond villain from another movie, I think. Adolfo Celi. What was he in? I think he appeared in another. He's in Thunderball and a bunch of, he's the villain. He's sort of the Blofeld character in the movie, and the movie opens. So this is the Zardoz thing. The movie opens and he's like watching a movie projected on naked women because that's what villains do. That's great. So Mystery Science Theater does, you know, shows this film. And so I watched the whole thing cause they're doing it's hilarious with them commenting on it. Right. And at some point they're back in the control room and it says, you know, where did Sean Connery, and Neil Connery's careers, you know, they both kind of went on this path. Like, well, there was a point at which they met. It's like, oh, here we go. Highlander 2, The Quickening. It was a good bunch.
According to the chat room, there's Highlander anime.
No. Oh, yeah. I didn't know this. There's like a cartoon or an animated film or something.
Several cartoons.
Oh, yeah. My God. Why did this happen?
Why did any of this happen?
I don't know.
How did a second one of these get made? Admittedly, it was 5 years later, so they had plenty of time to forget what a debacle it was. But was the second one like massively successful or something?
No.
But the second one apparently boosted DVD. I was just reading VHS sales of the first one. Like the second one actually helped cement the first one as a campy film.
Yeah. Well, what was really interesting, too, is the second one apparently has enough of a following that in 2004 they went back and with the aid of computer graphics did a special version of the second one. I would have loved to
have been on the visual effects team that did that remastering, just like showing up everywhere every day to work just like half drunk. It's like, oh my god, what are we doing again today?
It's not The Hobbit. Let's just say that. The other Sean Connery bit I wanted to mention is this terror. So Flophouse podcast, which do you guys listen to that? It's fantastic.
Yes, of course.
Okay. So it's awesome, right? And they did. So you listened to the one about the Guardians of the Islands.
Oh, God. It's so bad.
I had dug up some information about this. They didn't have all the details because they watched the production version. So this is the last film maybe that Sean Connery will ever be involved with because he's sort of, you know, he retired, right? He did the Indiana Jones about which shall not be spoken, right? He's in that? I never saw number four.
No, he wasn't. He wasn't in it. He retired from live action film. I can't remember what horrible thing he went out on, but it was not a good movie.
Was it the Catherine Zeta-Jones one?
No, I think it was after that. I recently saw that, the Entrapment thing. That was just not a good movie either, but worse than that. He did some other thing. It was not good. And that was his last one that he acted in person.
Oh,
and then
I see.
Sir Billy is known as Guardian of the Highlands is the one
League
that he did.
Extraordinary Gentlemen?
No, that's earlier. What is the last film? Transformer. I can't figure out what the. Yeah, I think so. 2007, he decided. Yeah, 2006, he retired from live acting. What was his last film?
IMDb says League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, then there was a James Bond video game, and then Sir Billy.
Oh my god, is League of Extraordinary Gentlemen the last film he was in?
Wow.
Ooh, goodness. That's one way to go out.
And then Sir Billy being the last production he was involved with. So Sir Billy, they were trying to understand how this terrible thing got made. And it looks like, you know, it was just the deal was it started as a 30-minute short. And Connery did the voices, voice for the main character. But, you know, he's probably in a studio for half a day or something, right? I mean, it's not a 30-minute film, not a lot of dialogue. And then they got more budget and they expanded it. But it sounds like it's like a total mess. The animation, you can see, I haven't seen the film. I've seen clips. It's just horrifically bad. The script is terrible. And they somehow turned it into a full-length film. Unbelievable.
Yeah, it's really something, especially when you take into account the producers and stuff talking about how Hollywood is trying to sabotage their film. God. Because did you read any of that?
It's
so weird. It's like, oh, Hollywood did not get all of these people together to write bad things about your movie.
Oh yeah, the Scotsman called it, the paper, mirthless and rudimentary. Flera called the CG the ugliest that I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. It just looks, it's just creepy and weird. The animation is like, it's 100% Uncanny Valley, but not even good.
No, it's not Uncanny Valley.
Oh no, what do you call it? It's like dead.
It's like dead Playmobil characters or something.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
That have been melted. It's not a good look. It's not realism and it doesn't approach realism. Like there's no, funky subsurface scattering or anything like that. So like all of the creases on their faces are like super dark, and they have weird shadows and everything's sort of flatly lit in primary colors. Like it's not, and a lot of also muddy textures. So it doesn't approach realism at any point, but it's not good. it's just bad. It's ugly.
It's funny. And what's funny is that sounds like among one of the worst things. Of all the things that they've covered in Flophouse, that is among one of the worst. Sean Connery. Well, so I have a friend. Here's just some more glenning. I have a friend who was a film reviewer in the 80s and 90s and helped her found an early film review site, in fact, back in the early days of the web. And she said, Sean Connery, she'd go on the junkets and interview folks. She said, Sean Connery, just dumb as a post. Just dumb as a post, like surprisingly stupid in person, which is disappointing because he's such an erudite on-screen presence, but still.
Yeah, maybe that's where he gets that sort of stoic charisma. It's just there's nothing behind the eyes.
It's like a little gerbil running on a wheel there.
Daniel Day-Lewis. I had never heard of this this Sir Billy thing, and I just I Google imaged some frames from it, and this is horrifying. These images.
Wipe it from your brain, and it's like it's apparently like all references to movies, but nothing. Is it for kids? Is it not? It just the whole thing sounded super creepy, and everything about it looks super creepy.
The one I'm looking at here, it's Grandpa Connery in a kilt, and then there's a young boy with the head of a goat. Standing next to him.
Yeah. Do you want to guess who's the goat?
I have no idea.
Alan Cummings.
Oh my God.
I know. Scottish. They got all weird? The Scottish actors. They said, this is about national pride. You got to come in for 4 hours. We'll link you up by ISDN from Hollywood and you can do it there. It'll only take a few hours. Alan, please. We need you for this.
Oh God. You should listen to the Flophouse episode, Dan. I don't have no desire to see the film, and I'd never heard of it before that. And then afterwards, when I decided I had to go look up to see like what it looked like that they were describing, I was just like, wow, this is sort of horrifying. And then their most recent one, which is about Fateful Findings.
Oh, I'm only a little ways into it. Don't spoil it.
Oh my God, that I want to see because it seems Jason Snell so just posted, bad.
It's on Amazon Instant Video, or you can stream it from there. So,
on Prime Video?
I can't believe it. It's what's it called? Faithful. Yeah, yeah, he just mentioned earlier today that he found it. So you can actually watch it.
I love the story at the beginning of the episode where they ordered it off the website. The DVD just never arrived.
Yeah, that's but a right. fan it's sent just... it in serendipitously.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It's Prime. Yeah. It's in Prime. It's in Prime. Oh. You can watch it for free. You can watch it.
Sold.
Oh man.
So Highlander's Hollander. A movie.
Yeah, we should probably wrap up that thing.
Thank you for making us watch this. I guess
It's my job to bring the joy of this movie to others. And But interesting things to talk about. That's the whole point.
I mean, the important thing that we learned is that they were born to be kings because they were the princes of the universe. And that made no sense, really, when you think about the lyrics. But that was great. Thank you, Glenn.
Thank you for allowing me to torture you. It's very kind of you.
No, it was. It's always fun to tear apart a movie with somebody who loves the movie and apparently realizes how ridiculous it is.
It's been an evolving process.
I still don't understand your affinity for this film, even if it's just pure nostalgia. It feels like just remembering being hit with a belt when you were a child or something.
It was such a, the 80s were a magnificent time, and this is evidence of that. You can have a movie about immortal Scottish people with terrible accents and bad sex scenes, and there you go.
This is a movie that got made.
This is a movie that got made again. That's right, again and again. thank you for having me.
Oh, thanks for being here. This was a blast.
Pleasure.
The end. Okay. Now we
likes to end by saying the end
because your catchphrase.
No, I just felt like we had several endings at that point. Now it's a kind of magic. A kind of magic. One dream, one soul, one prize, one goal, one golden glance of what should be. It's a kind of magic. One shaft of light that shows the way.
Well, we'll pick from one in the edit.
There's a cartoonist I know that goes by Ruben Bowling has created the cartoon that every day is the last day of the cartoon, and he got his syndicate. They got thought it was funny, so they're running it as a strip on comics.com, and so it runs every day. It's the same strip, and it's the comic strip that ends every day. It's been running, and people, the comments on it, because they're posting it new every day, and the archives go back for months now, and they created a fake identity for the cartoonist, and so people are posting comments to it. They don't get the joke, and they're posting comments to it. It's incredibly, I mean, some people do, and others are like, why are you doing this? Why do you keep, what's wrong with you? It's just great.